I'm Randy Mason of KCPT, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Gazing at the night sky in search of constellations can be tricky when city lights are in the way. Artificial brightness in urban areas is making it harder for us to experience pure darkness. This hour, we'll learn what we might be missing in the light and why it matters. We'll hear about the health effects of constant illumination and how our view from Earth has changed over the years. Later in the hour, I'll look at how you can get a better glimpse of the moon, planets, and stars right here in Kansas City. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Randy Mason from KCPT Public Television. Steve Kraske is away this week. Well, look up into the night sky here in Kansas City, and chances are you might not see all that many stars. Street lamps, buildings, and other artificial lights have turned us into a society that never really experiences true darkness. So, what is it that we're missing? For starters, constellations disappear from view and certain kinds of animals shy away. Our night vision isn't as good as it once was either. Here to tell us more about how nighttime is slipping out of our reach and really why that matters is author Paul Bogard. His new book is called The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Bogard joins us from way up north at the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in Duluth. Paul Bogard, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I think when people hear a book about visual pollution, nighttime skies that aren't able to be, you know, looked at the way they once were, they may think, is there a whole book to be found in that? But I'm guessing that along the way, you only found yourself believing that there's even more to write about than you may have thought when you started. Is that the case?
That's absolutely the case. I sometimes when people say, what book do you want to write next? I say, well, I just want to write another one about this subject because there's so much to talk about. But I guess, you know, what I would say is that the visual element and thinking specifically about the night sky and our ability to see the stars is a wonderful place to start. And the way that we've lost the night sky for the most part, especially in cities like Kansas City or any major city, but also out in the suburbs and even now into the rural areas. But this issue goes way beyond losing the night sky. So to touch on issues such as human health effects and ecological effects and all sorts of other things that folks may not have thought about.
Indeed, and we'll get to some of those because there's a few that are even a bit provocative, I think. But along the way, a very poetic take on a lot of this. I'm a math guy, though, at times, and I like the fact that you can measure darkness levels. I had no idea there's a scale. Maybe we should start with the sense that there really is a way to know how skies have become less dark.
Yeah, there's a scale that I use. I actually borrowed it from my table of contents. It's a 9-point scale. So the book starts with chapter 9 and works its way down to chapter 1. And this reflects what we call the Bortle scale. This was designed by an amateur astronomer in upstate New York who was tired of primarily younger amateur astronomers calling him and saying, oh, you have to come out and see. It's so dark out here. And he would get out to wherever they were, and he would realize that it really wasn't so dark. And so he created this 9-point scale that begins with our brightest places. So for me, it was Las Vegas, Times Square, that kind of place, and works its way down to 1, which would be a kind of primordial darkness where there's no evidence of artificial light. And the thing that always stands out to me about this scale is that most Americans live most of our lives in the levels that would correspond to 5 up to 9, that we just never spend time or very seldom spend time in areas that would be any darker than that.
What does that deprive us of?
Well, I think it deprives us of what has been, since there have been humans, this experience of walking out your door at night and coming face to face with the universe. You know, up until just a few decades ago, this was, if it was a clear night, an every night occurrence for a human. And there's just so many, it's kind of hard to quantify what we've lost as we've lost that experience of standing under so many stars, you can't count them, thinking about how small you are in the face of the universe, but also how large we are here on Earth. We really, it's a sense of perspective that, you know, there is no other place to go. This is what we have. We better take care of this planet. And I think to lose that perspective has some significant costs.
You mentioned Las Vegas. Among other places, you went to the bright spots to understand more of the darkness as well. This book really is, I think, a travelogue in a lot of ways, taking you across America and across the pond even for some looks at some of the ways it's done in other countries.
It was. And I mean, one of the first choices I had to make was, where do I go? Because obviously night comes to every place on the map. And I decided to focus on the lower 48 here in the States and then some spots in Europe. And the reason I did that was because primarily I didn't want, this isn't just a book about trying to find the darkest places in the world, you know, and going to some exotic location, you know, as one guy suggested to me at the start of my journey that I should just, it'd be way easier if you would just get on a plane and fly to Australia and drive out to the desert. I really wanted to focus on the nights that most of us experience. And so what kind of darkness do we experience and what kind of light do we experience as well?
Well, I expect a lot of folks around here can maybe relate to your Minnesota lake experience. Why don't we talk a little bit about what really it sounds like in a lot of ways was the genesis of maybe putting this together in the first place, your time up in Minnesota.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was so very lucky to grow up. I grew up in Minneapolis, but as so many Minnesotans do, my family had a cabin up north, as we say, and every summer we would go up there for weeks at a time. And so I grew up with the experience of standing at the end of the dock, watching, you know, satellites move through sugary spreads of stars, just so many stars that you, it seemed like, especially as a kid, there just were endless stars. And I really had that wonderful firsthand experience of the night sky that I think so many American children now never get to have. And that was one of the real sparks for me with this book, is to talk about that experience that we're losing.
Where would that be on the Bortle scale, just if I were to guess? Is that a 3 or 4?
I'm guessing when I was growing up, so this was in the 70s and 80s, we were probably down in the 3 range, maybe even on the 2. I think pretty dark. The thing that's happened, though, is that it's no longer that dark. It is still very dark, and I'm sure if I took folks from the city up there, they would say, wow, it's really dark up here. But there's so much evidence now, especially on the horizon, of the local towns, the lighting in those towns that are unshielded lights just going into the sky, and it's really starting to rob that sky.
There's that dirty word for you, unshielded light.
Well, it really is, and it's such an important concept. I think that, too often when people hear somebody like me talking about light pollution and controlling light, they think that what we're arguing for is we can't have any light. And that just simply isn't what we're saying. Really, what we're saying is light is wonderful. Light is a miracle. Light at night, it brings so many benefits to us, but we're using it we're using too much of it. We're using it in not smart ways. We're wasting a lot of it, and the costs to that are really high. And what I love about this issue is that it's something we can so easily do something about. The first step is to shield our lights.
Which cities are doing a little bit of, or are people still not even hearing the message on that one?
No, actually, there's some real good movement about on that, really all over Europe and even in the States here. Primarily, I would say shielding is happening for energy reasons. We're seeing a lot more, for example, street lights that are what we call full cutoff lights, where the light is instead of what we call a cobra head light, where we're all familiar with kind of the rounded glass street light. These are flat glass light where the light can only go straight down. And they're oftentimes LED lights to save energy. But this shielding our lights and having this full cutoff light can benefit us in so many other ways, too.
Well, we're talking with Paul Bogard here about darkness and about light. And you mentioned street lights there, Paul, which is, I think, one of the things in your book that starts intriguing people, the notion that more light doesn't necessarily always result in some of the things we assume it does. And crime is one of those areas where you think people have maybe been going on the wrong direction, that there is not necessarily the correlation we would absolutely expect, right?
Absolutely. I think when it comes to issues of safety and security and lighting and darkness, the first thing I would just say about that is that it's really a complex issue. And I think too often we reduce it to a simple equation, which is that because some light gives us some safety and security, more light will automatically make us safer and more secure. And I think that's where the equation falls apart. I would say that for a couple of reasons. When you start to have too much light and too much bright light, you start to run into problems such as glare, where you have bright lights just shining straight into your eyes, blinding you, making it actually harder for you to see. You have a lot of shadows that are being created where the bad guy can hide, you know, or plan his or her escape, that kind of thing, or you just don't see the obstacles in your path. And so this idea of that because some light brings us safety and security, more light brings us more safety and more security is one that I really want to call into question.
Do you get law enforcement support for that?
I do, actually. I spent a couple fun and adventurous nights with various police and talked with them a lot about that. And they made the point as well that you know, the bad guys are afraid of the dark, too, and that they think that what they see is that houses that are lit up will as often attract burglars as, for example, as deter them.
It's an interesting proposition. Our listeners may have some thoughts on it as well. We'd love to get them in on things. We're at 816-235-2888. That's the number here at Up to Date. We're talking with Paul Bogard about the end of night. And I like that notion that as you look into the skies, you're actually in touch with, I don't know, it's almost like a higher power. But we so often paint that darkness is a bad thing. And you've found that in other cultures, Native American, for example, night is actually part of the cosmology in a very different way.
It is. I was really pleased to find traditions that talked about light and darkness in a different way than we're usually used to in the West, which is seems to come down to light is good and dark is bad. And you don't have to spend too much time with this issue before you start to realize that light is good, but light can also be dangerous. And darkness has so much value to us. And so particular to the Native American folks that I talked to, they described their belief system as never all good or all bad, all light or all dark. There was always this mix, which I think philosophically, metaphorically, which is something I get into in the book, that really reflects life. I mean, life is almost never all good or all bad, all bright, all dark. There is always this mix.
Well, as you get out and about, you interact with some of these people from different cultures, and you even mentioned a tradition of opening up the night. I'd never heard of that. Can you explain that?
Yeah, isn't that that's a great tradition. One of the Indians I was talking to said this idea of sitting down at night and just listening to what's around you, a foot or two around you, and then just listening further out, further out, further out. And just, I think it really speaks to this idea of becoming aware of our surroundings, becoming aware of the night. And other folks, not necessarily in the Native traditions, talked to me about night consciousness. The fact that we, you know, it sounds kind of funny, but their argument that we have just kind of forgotten that night exists, that night is out there and that it is beautiful and valuable and important to us, and that it's in danger.
Well, some people who haven't forgotten it are those who work the night shift, which is another thing you examine in the book, that there's this whole possibility of a third shift, which, of course, wasn't so much of a possibility when artificial lighting wasn't so prevalent. And you find some, I think, maybe troubling things within some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. We could start with the fact that the World Health Organization now cites working the night shift as a probable carcinogen, equivalent to inhaling diesel fumes, for example. The reason, yeah, it doesn't sound too good. The reason they found this is primarily because, well, working at artificial light at night affects us in terms of our human physical health in three primary ways. The first is that it disrupts our sleep, and we could talk about sleep disorders and sleep problems in this country for a long time. It also confuses our circadian rhythms, those natural 24-hour rhythms that that orchestrate our whole body, the internal workings of our body. And then thirdly, it impedes the production of the hormone melatonin. And this is the link to the development of some cancers, primarily breast and prostate cancer at this point. I should say that, you know, the research on this is compelling, but it is just coming through right now because we haven't been looking at this, the effects of light at night, all that long. And as one guy said to me, you know, it's as though we're conducting an enormous ongoing experiment on ourselves.
Well, melatonin plays a role in that somewhere too, right?
Right. That's the third effect that I was talking about. So the hormone melatonin is produced only in darkness. Mm. So it you have to be in the darkness for this to be produced. And if you, you know, get up in the middle of the night to do whatever and you flip on the light switch, that stops that production of melatonin. And what's been shown by researchers is this connection between melatonin and the development of cancer. So the melatonin is a good thing. We want melatonin, and we need darkness in order to have it.
The needing darkness, I think, is the part that a lot of us have a little trouble wrapping our head around. We've been so often sort of pushing it aside, and your book is really an interesting way to bring up some of these thoughts. And I'm going to remind people that they may or may not have some of the same experiences, but I bet they've got a few thoughts on some of these things that you're bringing up. Would you feel comfortable, for example, with less streetlights? Like Paul says, maybe it does have a different effect than we expect, but you may have an opinion on that. We'd like to hear from you, or even on working the third shift. A lot of people actually, you know, seem to be pretty comfortable with it, while others struggle with some of the effects that Paul talks about in his book. We need to hear from you. Hear it up to date. It's 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. We can also be reached via email at uptodate@kcur.org. And we just did hear from Jack, who tells us he's been interested in this issue for years. He's an architect, and he's encountered several areas of the country that have regulations in zoning to actually address this issue, which gets me to sort of that notion, even though we're not going to say this is a contest to find the darkest place, everybody must want to know, what are some of these darkest places in the lower 48, Paul?
Well, speaking first of the zoning issues, there are some places you can go to in this country, such as Flagstaff, Arizona, and Tucson, Arizona, where you can experience modern American cities with lower levels of lighting. You know, I think too often we think that, this just isn't possible to do. It's entirely possible to do. So I would say that. In terms of natural darkness, the places I would really recommend are those places that we already love, namely the national parks in our country. Some of the most wonderful experiences I had in the book were in these places like Bryce Canyon, like Death Valley, like a Grand Canyon, a Great Basin in Nevada, where many of these parks now are having night sky programs where the rangers are giving talks and amateur astronomers are coming out to show us the stars. And in fact, the National Park Service now is thinking of darkness as one of the resources that it's sworn to protect. So I would really encourage people, you know, it's one thing to think about darkness, again, in some super remote area that nobody goes to, but I really want people to be thinking about it in the places where they live and the places they can get to.
Well, I liked hearing Death Valley because working on my television show, I have been around the country, and that's probably one of the places where I was struck by literally how close those stars felt. There's almost a 3D quality out there.
There really is, and I think, you know, that's the kind of experience that most of us don't have access to, or we don't take the time to get out to, that we just don't have anymore. The human eye is just a wonderful organ, and night vision is one of these things that people don't get to experience as often. But if you go outside, after 10 minutes, you're going to see a little bit better. After 45, you're going to see quite a bit better. But boy, if you stay out in a super dark area in a clear, dark night, after about 2 or 3 hours, just this sort of magical 3D thing happens that is really a wonderful experience.
Well, we've got Kathy from Mission on the line, and if I can manipulate this phone accurately, we'll get her into the conversation. Kathy, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thank you.
Enjoying
yes,
the con-
I just,
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry, I just wanted to say that I was driving and heard your comments, and I've been concerned about the darkening of America for years, 30 years probably, having grown up in Rapid City, South Dakota, in the mountains area. But my point is, only in recent years have I found the ability to get out of the city, exactly what you said, to the state parks or to the country when someone lives there, to actually experience, you know, getting in the dark to see the stars the way I did when I was a child 50 years ago. So your comments were very on target with me. My question, I guess, is how can we teach our children and our grandchildren in a better way about appreciating the dark? My thoughts are to get them out there in a tent and then try to get to the country, but your comments would be appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's that experience, that first-hand experience is the most vital thing that we can do. And I should say that in many places, even metro areas, maybe like a Kansas City or certainly Minneapolis, those there are going to be astronomy clubs or nature centers that are doing night sky programs that, you know, you don't have to drive all that long. You can put the kids in the car and head out and have a wonderful firsthand experience that might then inspire you to go a little further afield, maybe go out west and see some of the national parks, for example.
Great, Kathy. Thanks for your call. We've got
next. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Next call coming in from next from Ozaki. We've got Kirk. You've got a question about jet travel.
Yes. Hi. Yes, I'm Kirk. And this all came to the fore for me because now, of course, I live in a rural part of Kansas. And one driving reasons for me to locate there is I appreciate night sky. I appreciate darkness. Also appreciate the lack of noise around me as well. So that's why I choose to live rural. Now, when I was young, I noticed prior to jet travel back in the 50s, and my vision was quite exceptional then, and I could see clearly for miles, and the night sky was so bright and so clear. I really didn't notice until following 9/11, when the skies were cleared of all air travel, I noticed that same quality of sky, both day and night, that I remembered from my youth. And I was wondering if you have looked into the effects of jet travel on high sky pollution and light blocking and light retention and just general overall visibility in your work.
You know, that's something I haven't actually looked at. It makes some sense to me. And I remember, too, the 9/11 when the skies were clear, how different that was. But I would say, too, to the caller, one of the things that resonates with me is this going together of darkness that he wanted and also the quiet that he wanted. And I think so often if you get to a dark place, you're going to get to a quiet place, and vice versa. If you're in a bright place, it's going to be loud. And both darkness and quiet, so important to us, I think, physically, spiritually, mentally, and both qualities that are increasingly threatened.
All right. Well, I think it's a good conversation underway. More of your calls to come when UpToDate returns. We'll continue our conversation with Paul Bogard about the end of the night. And later in the hour, we will, in fact, talk with a local astronomer about what you can see from our own Kansas City skies. I am Randy Mason, in this week for Steve Kraske, and you are listening to UpToDate on KCUR. Right now, the conversation is about a topic that I'm finding actually very fascinating, the end of night and how, you know, this light pollution, different people call it different things, but the way that we no longer spend our time under the skies with maybe as much reward as we once did is the topic here with author Paul Bogard. Paul, as you got around the country, it seemed like you found people who really were energized by this chance to really reconnect with the nighttime sky. I'm thinking of people in Tucson and actually the bats in Austin were even an example of it. Seems like you're finding different pockets of reconnection.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, all it takes for most people is, again, this firsthand experience of real night, of real darkness, and people fall in love with it. The bat subject that you mentioned is a good example of that. When this is in Austin, Texas, and when bats first came back to the Congress Avenue Bridge in Austin, there was a real outcry. You know, the public was afraid of rabies and afraid of being attacked by bats. And the experts said, you know, just give it time. It's going to be okay. You have nothing to be afraid of. And sure enough, a couple decades later, the bats that emerge from under the bridge, and we're talking hundreds of thousands, a million and a half bats, have become a huge moneymaker for Austin, with drawing tourists and people really in the city see it as a point of pride that, yeah, we're the bat city. We have, you know, this thing for you to come look at. So it just, in so many things when it comes to nighttime and darkness, it just really takes a little bit of, as I said before, night consciousness, a little bit of education about what's safe, what's really truly dangerous, and having this firsthand experience.
Well, you are a guy who even confesses to being a little bit afraid of the dark in the book, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, people get a kick out of that. You know, the guy that wrote the book on the value of darkness admits to being afraid of the dark. But, you know, I think that's a totally natural human feeling. And I think it goes back to a little bit earlier our discussion of safety and security, because, you know, to be human at night is to be out of our element. We can't see as well. We're a little unsure of things. And I think, again, that's totally natural. Light can help us feel better about that. Light can help us be safe. It's, again, just that we're using so much light, much more than we need, that starts to bring these costs.
Well, we talked earlier about some of the health issues that might be, you know, an outcome of too much light. Let's check in with caller. This would be Susan. Susan, you're on the air here with our guest. Let's talk about the end of light with him.
Hi. I'm wondering if the loss of night with the decrease in melatonin production could be associated with the increase of folks being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders. Just a few years ago, you'll recall there was a big thing in the news about 1 in 100 kids, and then it was down to 1 in 88. And last week, the NIH published a study saying it was down to 1 in 50 kids. And I know my daughter requires a great deal of melatonin to sleep at night, and she has been surrounded by light her whole life. In fact, we live north of the river where they have the orange street lights surrounding us, so we can never get dark.
Well, that's an interesting take on all this. Anything you've come across so far, Paul, on that?
Not specifically to that, but I would say a couple things your caller said that resonate with me. The first is just that when I give talks, it is always the folks who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who come up and say, tell me, share their experience of night. It is never folks in their 40s and younger who do that. And I think, you know, as your caller said, her daughter, as have most young Americans, has grown up surrounded by light. We haven't known anything different. The second thing I would say, just any kind of health effect, is that all life on Earth evolved with bright days. We need bright days. but also dark nights.
Dark night.
And we need dark nights as well. And that's what we're losing. We're not losing the bright days. We're losing the dark nights. We need that for our health as well.
Thank you, Susan, for your call. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting when you said that, it reminded me of, was it Henry Beston that you encountered on Cape Cod?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He has some great quotes. Today's civilization is full of people who have not the slightest notion of the character or the poetry of night, who have never even seen night. Yet to live thus, to know only artificial night, is as absurd and evil as to know only artificial day. When you think of it in those terms, it kind of changes how all this comes across in our, you know, modern world, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I, you know, Beston's book, The Outermost House, is full of this imagery of nighttime from being on Cape Cod. And the fascinating thing for me is that he was writing in the 1920s.
Yeah.
So he was talking about, he says, lights with lights and ever more lights, we drive the holiness and beauty of night back to the forests and the seas. And he, again, this is, you know, 80, 90 years ago. Yeah, we lose so much when we lose an experience of the truly dark sky.
Speaking of the sky, and James Turrell comes up briefly in this, the artist. And I just had the chance to see one of his installations in Houston, Rice mm-hmm. University. He is an artist who is now really playing with the notion of putting people back in touch with some of that. Have you seen a Turrell piece?
I haven't seen it, but I do talk a little bit about his Rodin crater outside Flagstaff because he one of the experiences he wanted to create for folks is what we call celestial vaulting.
Yes,
exactly.
I love that term.
Yeah, great title. But this it's that sense of kind of the sky opening as though a vault, and you're kind of falling into the stars, kind of sensation. And boy, what an amazing experience. And you have to, the sky has to be dark for that. And I feel like I've had that experience a couple times during the writing of the book. And one time in particular that I read about at the opening point is as I'm driving through Nevada and I've turned the lights off on the car. And it's kind of one of those experiences that might not be the smartest thing to do, but it sure was fun.
Yeah, I was thinking kids don't try this at home necessarily
exactly.
when reading about that. But it was that. That again, that sense of putting yourself in the arms of this all-enveloping night, which it makes for a very poetic read, and I think that's part of what I really enjoyed about your book, Paul, is that
you found
so much beyond just stats, just numbers, and it's a great mix of those things.
Thank you, and I think that's one thing that's so nice about the subject is that it is a mix of stats and numbers and poetry. So I write about the moon, for example, and how the moon is brighter at certain times of the year, and you know you can cite astronomical facts about the moon. But for me, the moon has always been, I love the moon when it feels like it's close to the Earth, almost a friend, almost a part of our experience. So you can have both those kinds of elements.
Well, you know, I think with that in mind, and the chance for us to actually talk about some of the local manifestations with someone we've got in the studio. I'm going to let you take some time back there in the Great North Woods and further explore what may be a second book, because I think you're absolutely right. I got to the end of this and thought, it's over? It seems like you could meet a whole lot more people who will continue to expound on, you know, just so many cultural, scientific and human aspects of night that I would never, ever have guessed would make such a good read. So thanks so much for joining us here on Up to Date, Paul. It's great having you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Paul Bogard's book is titled The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light.